Thursday, July 16th, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. And tonight, your host, Poke Runyon and Fretter Solomon, will discuss and perhaps briefly demonstrate a path working to the late medieval artist Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights, created and narrated by Fretter Solomon. Now, this was recently performed at Montsalvat for Inner Order members, and because of the complexity of the imagery, it should be considered an advanced working. The presentation was enhanced by graphic backgrounds and sculptural figures placed on the altar, making it something of a perky path layout. The spectral guide was a figure from Bosch's Revelation of St. John the Divine, called Titanilus, a surrealistic version of a church choir proctor with an insect's tail. So, if you want to open up your mind's eye and step into this fantasy land, we'll tell you how it's done. Let me explain a little bit about a few of the things I just mentioned in the abstract. In the first place, we talked about, I mentioned the perky pad layout. Now, we've discussed this before in connection with the works of Philip K. Dick. And to explain what a perky pad layout is, one of Phil Dick's novels concerned colonists on Mars who lived in a subterranean, and they lived in subterranean bunkers, somewhat similar to missile silos. And life was pretty harsh and boring. And so they Fratter Solomon's on, but he told me to let me go ahead and before I bring him on, I'm going to go ahead and finish the introduction here. Anyway, these colonists on Mars lived down in these underground bunkers, and they entertained themselves with these urban or suburban layouts of a typical middle American suburban home, and sort of on a tabletop. This is kind of similar to a kid's railway train layout on a tabletop, which many of you are familiar with. And they have a suburban house and a garage and a car and all that, and a dollhouse, and sort of, you know, it's like, and then they had figures actually very, very similar to Ken and Barbie, Mattel Ken and Barbie figures, and they would literally, it sounds like kids playing with dolls, which is what they were doing, except they enhanced this whole procedure with a psychedelic drug called Can-B, and then they were able to enter their layouts and actually be perky and pat and live a suburban life and sort of a little soap opera that they had, and it was a form of virtual reality, or virtual reality game, kind of a cross between having an electric train in your basement and a Monopoly board. But so that is where the perky pat idea comes from, and we've used that for temple setups and various things. But this, what we did with this one is we used Bosch, Hieronymus Bosch action figures, which are really, really fascinating. And these action figures were used on the altar, and we set up the triptych behind them, so they formed a kind of a diorama, if you've ever seen one of these dioramas, like a movie set where you have models in the foreground and a painting in the background, and the whole thing sort of goes together. That's how we set this up, and then Fratter Solomon got us into a trance, and we did the path working. Planner Solomon, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. What I would like you to do is to tell us. First, let's talk about all of the everything that went into putting this thing together, like getting the action figures and the Bosch figures, and explain to us how we set the whole thing up. And would you go ahead and tell us about that and the preparation
yeah.
you went into for it? Go ahead.
Well, what's really neat is a company called Lucion in Netherlands decided, hey, let's make action figures out of Bosch. It's a really popular, he's a really popular painter. So I got all these figures because Polk absolutely loves surrounding with Bosch, and so do I. He's got a really neat big triptych of the Garden of Earthly Delights. And it inspired me. It made me think, you know, we go to all these wonderful places on our path workings, but why not Bosch? The symbolism's so rich. And it really is. So the first one we did, because we just had the right devices to start it, was the Garden of Earthly Delights. We had the triptych, and we had all the statues to go with it. So we had the board over last week, and I thought, you know, this could really be fun. And so I started working on a path working, and it's been in the making for, we've been talking about it for the past couple months. It's probably going to evolve into 6th degree material. Just to give you a little background on the Garden of Earthly Delights, there's three tip triptychs. One represents the triptych on the left. You can look it up if you want online, if you have access to a computer, the Garden of Earthly Delights by Bosch. You have the Garden of Eden, you have Adam and Eve, and what appears to be Jesus Christ in the center. In the centerpiece, you have Paradise on Earth, which represents Bosch's envisioned paradise of the Adamites, who were a sect that says, let's go back to living the way that Adam and Eve did and dance around naked and we'll be fine. And I read something this week that I think is worth noting, and that is that this actually represents what Bosch would probably have envisioned the New World, the Americas, which had been recently discovered, to be the place where the Adamites could have placed their paradise. There's the New Jerusalem in the Book of Revelation, it's actually described it's about the same size as the continental United States. so it was the perfect place to envision, hey, if there's going to be a paradise on Earth, it's not going to be here, it's going to be there. They were in the midst of a war, which makes the panel on the right actually where Hieronymus Bosch was living. And the big hint that actually represents the Earth in the 1500s is because Hieronymus Bosch actually paints himself in the portrait. Now, you can see him, his face is on the eggshell tree man. But what I decided to do is we can't have this on Earth if we're going to do a path working, and we want to start experimenting with the stars. So this also represents the spiritual plane. So I decided I couldn't find when Hieronymus Bosch was born because nobody knows, but I could find out when he died, and he died in the constellation of Leo. So I researched Leo, and within Leo, there is one of the stars actually has a planet they've discovered around it, and that star was called Rasala by the Arabs, or Mu Leonis by the Greeks. So I decided I'm going to take you guys to this planet, and we're going to experience his spiritual realm, because we know when we pass on, we go back into the zodiac, and we go back through our cycle, so this was the perfect place to put it. And so with that being said, I put up the triptych, which Polk had on our altar, and then I took all the figurines, and I placed them relatively close to where they were on the triptych, and I took the participants on a journey so they could experience what each of these things little meant. And the good thing about that is it really allows us to delve into that altered state of mind that Bosch was in when he was creating these things. And with that being said, Rasala is a star that is on it's 122 light years away. So I decided to find out what exactly was going on 122.7 years ago, so I could actually take you back to the time that we're seeing Rosala right now. I was able to point the participants to exactly where Rosala was from the temple. It was in the direction of Gabriel. Leo is sitting behind Gabriel's quadrant right now. So with that being said, Pope, do you want me to cue it up and get everybody started to listen in?
Yeah, we were saying that we wanted to just do the first say 10 minutes of it. We could run it here and put the put the phone up the speaker. We can't. Block Talk Radio couldn't load it and so. We'll do it, but before we get into doing about 10 minutes of it, let me say a few things about this. For one thing, we didn't have like Phil Dick's book. We didn't have any candy, but we did have some mugwort essential oil, which I passed around, and everybody had a and the mugwort essential oil. If you put it in your diffuser. Is nice for lucid dreaming, and of course the best time to do lucid dreaming is that I found is in the hypnopompic state when you're just waking up in the morning. That's when you can really do it. But the thing about this Hieronymus Bosch working. That makes it really an inner order project is a tremendous complexity of this their Garden of Earthly Delights and other works of Bosch that need to be studied. The symbolism needs to be studied, and some people who are already doing that. I mean, this is. Quite frankly, Hieronymus Bosch is becoming a cult, and as you can probably imagine, and one guy, and I was reading tonight, one guy said every time I look at the Garden of Earthly Delights, the figures have moved; they're in different places. And of course, people thought he was a bit dingy, but this sort of thing can get absolutely entranced with this thing, and it's like an Abraham Merritt story where you step into you see the ship of Ishtar and the little figures move around on the deck, and then you go to the ship and have your adventures on the ship, and this is. And Merritt also wrote one called The Dragon Glass, where you go through this painting, you go into this painting and a Chinese painting, and actually walk down the road up into the Chinese mountains, and this is the sort of thing that we're working on here is to enter this world, and we have by the way, the book, our yoga book is out. And I'm sent several copies of it, and we're going to be available to members only, by the way, for this year. And we have a method for opening the third eye and actually stepping out into these things, and it's in this book. And this method will work perfectly once we get this path working perfected. Now, with that in mind, you go ahead. Go ahead, Mike, and play the first. Let's just run the first 10 minutes of the path working, and from your end, and we'll see how it plays. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Getting it teed up now.
Are you started yet?
Yeah. For some reason the volume's kind of low, so.
I don't hear it. We want to run it from our end. Shall we run it from our end?
Yeah, it seems like when I'm on a phone call, it mutes the sound significantly.
I'm going to go ahead and run the first 10 minutes from our end. Okay.
Yeah. That's
okay.
A good idea.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Zandria. Run the first in.
Notice the sense of peace which is coming over your body. Allow your eyes just to gently relax. You're going in the direction of water, and you are feeling peaceful waves from the Archangel Gabriel overcoming you, putting you in a wonderful state of absolute peace. And as you allow your eyes to close, notice what you are to remember and let it settle inside your mind. Deeply, powerfully, and wonderfully. All the stresses, all the concerns of this realm are gone. For you are proceeding to a time before you were even born. 122.5 years ago. Peaceful, relaxed, you are entering a time when you were spirits, free from the cumbersome natures of your daily lives. And you are entering into a realm which is the same. You can feel peaceful, soothing waves in your toes, relaxing all the tension in your feet from the ankles below is totally, absolutely, and completely relaxed as your spirit begins to withdraw itself up through your calves and your shins into your knees. All that which is below is left behind as your spirit body becomes more condensed and feels like loose rubber bands. Your thighs, totally relaxed, as though they were dropping to the ground like soft milk. Light, completely relaxed. Your midsection falls like a heavy bowling ball. It drops. You can feel your spirit totally disconnect from your stomach, gradually your chest, your lungs. Your body is doing what it needs to do, while your spirit, your consciousness, pulling itself up from the fingers, the tips of the fingers. It is becoming totally relaxed. The hands, you can feel them drop from you as your consciousness floats up, flutters up like butterflies, to the point it's up in your shoulders like air, and your consciousness begins to strangely rise like helium separating from the rest of the air. You can feel your spirit knocking against the tops of your heads. It is knocking. It is ready to leave. Your consciousness is ready to go up. It is ready to race to the constellation of Leo, to the star called Rosala. Notice your spirit. It becomes more condensed, and then pop. You are now standing before the altar and hopping on the altar altogether. You look at Tantalus, that scribe who records all your sins. The statue seems to become alive, as you can see. It's taken over by the spiritual presence which emanates from it. He points towards the two canoes of the eggshell tree man, whom life was Hieronymus Bosch, as you can see his face, that broken eggshell. He points. The eggshell tree man. You all load up. You get inside the canoe, two in each, and you prepare for your journey, wondering how a tree man with canoes for feet is going to take you there. But it is no mystery, for you notice Tantalus, all of a sudden those wings he has spread out, and he flutters above, grabbing two branches of Hieronymus Bosch, now as a tree man. He flies you there. He introduces you under his new magical name, Dork Nybro. As he's flying, he speaks to you. I died in Leo, to Orag's moon, Jagerdon, Purgatorium, Hieronymus, I did go. Volcanic and smoggy, I went in a rush. Born again on Orag's moon, Alessinara, Paradisium Hieronymus, like Eden it was, and all rather plush. You're flying now, 122 years into the past towards that light. And you see a planet that looks remarkably like Jupiter. This is Orag. You see a dark moon, and you see a beautiful green and blue moon. But you go to the dark one, and this is Jagerdon. This is where, in the painting, you saw the smog and the fire. You land on the planet, the moon, rather. It lands in a dark river. You get off, and you notice the sights around you. You notice things in particular that stood out when you were looking in the painting. But you look towards two ears that are stuck together with a knife through them, and you wonder as to its meaning. The two ears don't speak to you, but you know its name. For Hieronymus Bosch, as Gork Nybro tells you, that is Adoka Dodigrik, the pierced ears. Adoka has nothing to say, but you notice your own ears come together. As even blackness disappears from your eyes, and there is no vision, there is only sound. And you get this message. What have you heard that was evil or ill-intentioned and internalized? Believing without thinking. That is the reason these ears are together. They symbolize the time we believed without thinking. And you can feel a dagger pierce through your ears. This is because this is purgatory. Not as a hellish eternal punishment, but for you to recognize, to cut yourself off from foul talk. Gork then points you out to Sinara, the snake nun, you being led by Tantalus, who is silent. A good snake or a bad nun? Wicked, for she had a deceitful tongue. In life, she chastised the old and deceived the young. Tantalus then points you to Clope, the knighthead with legs but no arms. How peculiar a sight. A pid nun. Quite a fright. Clope, the knight with legs and no arms, with a raven's head. I run to devour, no hands here to do good, because in life I only fought and took. Claiming to give was just not in my power. Papisha, the pig nun. She cannot speak, but Gork describes her. A good pig or a bad nun? This nun only gorged off tithes, giving nothing back.
Okay, that's about 10 minutes. Are you there, Mike?
Yes, I am.
Okay, that's about 10 minutes. I want to mention you have the big great big fat Bausch book by Wilhelm Franger. The German
yes,
car.
Yes, I do.
The one that I inherited from my beloved mentor Frederick Adams. And I want to mention that that Wilhelm Franger has a different concept of the Garden of Earthly Delights triptych than just about everybody else does. He has a concept that both Fred Adams and I really liked, and that is that the center panel with all the delightful nudists frolicking around with the hummingbirds and everything else, that represents the paradise of the Adamites, of the Adamite sect, and that the side with all the torturous stuff going on, the one that we were going through, is over there, is not really purgatory or hell. It's the world. It's the real world as it was in Bosch's time. And then, of course, the Garden of Eden over on the other side, that is what it is, and leading to the paradise of the Adamites, which was their idea of how to go back to Eden. In other words, they wanted to recover innocence by returning to paradise and being innocent like Adam and Eve and just avoiding the snake, you know, and they returned to innocence, kind of like the concept of the pure fool at the top of the tree and the arch fool at the bottom of the tree, which we're familiar with and in the Hermetic Kabbalah. That said, that concept, of course, is a lot more. I'm much more in favor of that concept than I am the idea of hell. And by the way, when you review the history of the Netherlands, where Bosch grew up and where he worked at the time he was working all the way up through, you realize that Fanger's concept is perhaps pretty accurate, because Spain inherited the Holland, the Netherlands, as a result of the Habsburg dynasty. This was kind of a tangled royalist politics in the Holy Roman Empire, and the Habsburgs were also related to the Spanish, and so they ended up, the Spanish ended up controlling Spain for all the way from the 1400s on through the 1700s, and so there, along comes the Protestant Reformation, and the Spanish being the super Catholics, and the Reformation taking place in a lot of it in the Netherlands. The Netherlands during Bosch's life was mostly an absolute hell. It really looked like that right hand side of the triptych. They had the 80. They won the 100 years. It was the 80 years war, and the country was just devastated. And they were killing each other over religious issues. And it sounds like the Middle East today. And it was very much like the Middle East today, and the Spanish. The Spanish were acting like ISIS is acting today, and the Inquisition. And by the way, the Inquisition was chasing Bosch. They were very suspicious of his form of spiritual pornography. But at the time they were chasing him, Philip of Spain, the king of Spain, was making a private collection of Bosch's artwork. And becoming Bosch's biggest fan. So I want to point this out that may not be purgatory. That may just really be Bosch's representation of what was going on in the Netherlands at the time.
There's a huge hint, Polk, that you're absolutely right. And that's the fact that he painted it in the painting himself. And what we have to understand about Netherlands at the time, it was a very devout nation. And one thing that we don't think about, we like to put hell off somewhere outside of the universe and heaven somewhere outside of the universe too. But back then, the spirit realm was very real, and it wasn't far below and it wasn't far above. It was with them. They had spirits running around all the time in their mind. So all of these things that he's depicting, you have the burning buildings, which is something he actually saw. And what this eggshell tree man represents is how Bosch probably felt with everything that he was doing and everybody that he was seeing. Like, he was probably seeing a lot of hypocritical nuns, and that's why you see the nuns depicted the way that they are. You see a priest here, or a bishop, and he's depicted in a negative light in this column. So that's definitely what he's doing, is he's depicting the spiritual world as it is. And this bird, this blue bird devil, who's swallowing people, and that represents people dying. And I like what you pointed out. That probably represents reincarnation symbolically too. But people are being dropped into the ground.
There is so much depth in this work. I mean, this is a lifetime. This can be a lifetime study of Bosch symbolism, and it can be a lifetime study. And some people think he was an alchemist. He certainly was familiar with it. Carl Jung thought he was. I've been going over these various theories, and you can do a lot of studying on the internet, because a lot of it, you know, a lot of the different theories and all are available on the internet. Once you start Googling Hermetus Bosch, you're off on your quest. And I want to encourage our people, especially people that are progressing in the order, because this really is an inner order kind of a thing. I mean, it's really, really complex. The other
comparable to Tibetan Buddhism, like their meditation.
Yeah, it's very much like Tibetan Buddhism. I wanted to mention this. It is, in a way, it reminds me of the Kalachakra Tantra. And the reason why it does is because the Kalachakra Tantra, the visualizations are so vastly complex. They're vastly complex. And that's because it is the highest level Tantra that the Tibetans have. And in a sense, Bosch's symbolisms, in a sense, can be the Hermetic traditions, one of the Hermetic traditions' highest tantras, because it's a massive, massive work, and mastering it, on the spiritual side, would, as I say, it can be a lifetime study. And the idea of being able to actually go into this. Remember when we started out talking about this project, I wanted to kind of do a Dan Brown type story, Langdon kind of story, where the archaeologist or the philosopher or whatever, he goes to he visits the Prado in Spain, and he's looking at the painting, and the guardian in the form of a monk comes up behind him, and sort of taps him on the shoulder and whispers in his ear, "You want a closer look?" Something like that. And the King Philip has a secret grimoire that he has developed along with a magician, somebody, they developed this method of getting into, of actually a magical ritual for getting into the Bosch world, and make a story out of this. We were thinking about that, and we discussed it, and that's where I got you thinking about who the guardian ought to be, and then you selected how do we see out of this
well,
name. I gotta hug it. Dwight Titanillus becomes the guardian, and I said, well, we'll make him a monk. We'll make him a monk for the sake of
he's the perfect candidate.
Yeah, make him a monk in the Prado art gallery, and yet we can't have his great big insect tail. Well, you know, he's trying out from under his monk's robe. That's possible, but that he would be the, because yeah, he's a choir master, and he looks like a choir master, you know, with his face. And he would be the guardian, and then we could have King Philip's old grimoire in a glass case, you know, opened up an illuminated manuscript. And that's the ritual on how to get into the path working. The whole idea is really, really, I think it's fascinating. You know, these little figures, these wonderful little sculptural figures, and I know you got quite a collection of them now. And of course, I'm going to start developing a collection too, because I find this whole subject absolutely fascinating. But let's talk a little bit about Spain under the Spaniards. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, Hieronymus Bosch was really he was in quite a pickle. I mean, he was favored by the king but hated by the Inquisition, and that confusion and that fear, but that desire to please really. It really just ignited some incredibly beautiful imagery, but scary imagery at the same time. You could tell he hated the hypocrisy of the Inquisition, because if you look at the Garden of Earthly Delights, one thing that you'll notice is you don't see a single nun, bishop, or priest. You only see them where he's painting the hellish world, which shows that what he's doing is he's criticizing the hellish Europe that he lived in, because it was literally a hell on earth at that time. It was very scary. The Inquisition was very evil. And the figures who seem to be painted to the worst tend to be the nuns, bishops, and knights are the ones that are depicted as the worst beings, because they were the ones who were in charge of all the killing.
I want to mention, speaking of the Inquisition, they also made inroads into Italy. They constantly, because the Spaniards were constantly going into Italy during the Renaissance, you know, and they made an incursion into Italy, and took over Florence back in about 1300. The Inquisition took over Florence, and the first European magician to do a goetic evocation in a mirror, by the way, was Secco de Ascoli, and he wrote a book about it and mentioned his summoning this goetic demon in a mirror. And mentioned that in a book he had on astrology, and he went over and visited Florence and didn't realize that the Spanish Inquisition was in charge in Florence, and they grabbed him and burned him at the stake. These people were
more evil than anything that they were going after,
like Monty Python. I was joking about it when we talked about Secco de Ascoli some time back. You know, he got over to Florence and nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. You know, like Monty Python saying, they must have been in Holland with the Calvinists, especially in Holland. What a horrible mess that must have been. And see, we see all of that reflected in Bosch's work. Now, what do you think about What do you think about the idea of creating a vehicle? Let's say if we were to place this, as you have, on another planet, we use our Kusor's boat for advanced, you know, for flying over path we've already done in higher spheres of the Tree of Life. But in this case, I think that Tree of Life flying saucer design might be a good idea. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really neat, because if we're going into the stars,
yeah,
it goes back to the tradition of the Hebrew tradition of a Merkaba or the wheels. Ezekiel talked about these wheels that were flying towards the heaven. So if anything is a flying saucer, is obviously wheel shaped, and the Polk's design is really brilliant. It's got on the bottom of one side, it has the zodiac, which really it helps key you into the stellar system, and we're going to be using that. I have the other ones. I'm starting to flesh out the other ones, and I use the zodiac based on particular dates as far as triggering you into the star system. So the flying saucer is brilliant after we get the Soma Sophia developed, we're going to be going into the stars. What we've been doing, like in the outer order, Kusor, it's more of an internal journey, but this is a journey that really, you know, it spreads you out into the entire universe. So the flying saucer is a good vehicle to really, you know, we went in the mind. Now what we want to do in the inner order is expand the mind to fill the whole universe.
Well, what I've been thinking in regard to that wheel, or it literally is, the term flying saucer is a bit campy.
1900s.
Maybe we ought to call it the heavenly wheel, because what it is the spheres of the Tree of Life around in a circle, and they revolve, and so it looks, and they revolve, and of course. And we can have some interesting tonalities when that occurs. And then I used a unicursal, a kind of a flexible unicursal hexagram in the middle, sort of as the engine that runs the whole thing, put the breath in the middle of it. So it becomes a revolving Tree of Life. And that way it's a revolving Tree of Life that could go through the da'at or Saturn gate and be off on its way. And we need some sort of a magical vehicle, and I think that's probably better than using the Kusor's boat. Actually, could spread its wings and fly off into outer space, and I've done that before with Kusor's boat. But I think that it's better to do something like this. These are all plans that we have for. Well, basically, they're 6 degree type techniques and workings. I think that the Bosch, the whole Bosch universe or Bosch realms, we ought to start collecting and researching the symbolism from a Hermetic point of view, and get that together and keep working on this. So any final thoughts before we conclude here?
We got 15 minutes, so I'll talk a little bit about his other two paintings. One's really neat. The symbolism is absolutely amazing because it was in the 1500s, and that is the Temptation of Saint Anthony. That's going to be taking place in the continent of Capricorn when Saint Anthony's the feast day is Saint Anthony of Alexandria, and I couldn't find any planets that we discovered in Capricorn yet, but I did find a messier object. So there's a really big star cluster we're going to be able to go to find the planet where all that took place. So we'll have fun. But one of the neat figures that's in there on the left-hand triptych is a birdman, really big birdman. He's got a red cloak on. And on the side, he's got a lapel. It's yellow with a blue square and compass. It's a Masonic symbol, and it existed in the 1500s before we knew that masonry, we don't have proof that masonry existed, solid proof that scholars agree on. But to me, this is an indicator that maybe, just maybe, he was a Mason before masonry was as widespread as it became in the 1700s.
Yeah, you showed me that, and I think we showed that to Philos too, and that's really amazing, because it looks like, yeah, it does. It looks just exactly like a square and a compass, and nobody added that to the painting. That's original, and Bausch is just really a treasure trove of marvelous images, you know, and. There's a magic mirror in the on the right hand side of on the right hand side of Garden of Earthly Delights down there toward the bottom. There's a magic mirror on somebody's rear end, actually, and I think there's a girl that's been shot through the heart looking into it. It's kind of gruesome, but it's definitely a magic mirror, and there is all sorts of symbolism in this. And these paintings that are just absolutely, you know, they're hermetic, and you know Bausch was certainly into hermetic arts, and there's no doubt, and I'm absolutely fascinated. Now there's also, let's see, there's the hay wain. We can talk about that a little bit. What do you think about the hay wain?
The hay wain, I don't want to say I'm underwhelmed, but if you look at the hay wain, it was really a prequel to the Garden of Earthly Delights. The Garden of Earthly Delights, what Hieronymus Bosch did with hay wain is he took this concept and he took it to the next level, and he really detailed it. I think the Garden of Earthly Delights is him going back to what he did in hay wain, adding what he thought is an afterthought. So the neat thing about the working that we did is it pretty much takes you through hay wain, except it's far richer and more complex. He made the Garden of Earthly Delights later, and it's very thick in symbolism. There's some neat figures that are in hay wain that are not named Garden of Earthly Delights, but for the most part, if you look at the two, you'll see what he did is he was really inspired by what he did in hay wain. And that is a painting alone that you can really look at and stare at for hours. But this one, that was what the King of Portugal, he literally stared at that painting for hours, because it's so fascinating and it's so in depth, and it was made just for him. Hieronymus Bosch, when he made the Garden of Earthly Delights, he wanted to make something that kind of in a way was for everybody. And if you really get it, this is something that you can, like you said, you can't just stare at this thing for hours. You could literally stare at this for the rest of your life, because each little component has such rich symbolism. And living the type of life that he did, Hieronymus Bosch just had to be pumping with adrenaline, because the threat of death was so prevalent on somebody as provocative as him as an artist. I mean, his art is really... it's very shocking, and it's very much against the establishment. And so he was triggered by all this. You know, he was seeing death everywhere, and you can see the rich symbolism both in hay wain and in the Garden of Earthly Delights. Now looking at the hay wain, he does have a richer depiction of the Garden of Eden in a way that's actually significant. Remember how we talked about Elohim and Jehovah being separate in the Old Testament? He paints Elohim in the sky, but Jehovah's on the ground with Adam and Eve. He seems to distinguish the two when he paints them in this picture in a way that's kind of interesting. You have a being on the ground who's Jehovah talking to Adam and Eve, and then you have Elohim who's more in the sky. And I don't know what he was keyed in on, but, you know, at least on a subconscious level, we know that there's a God who's all-powerful and loving in the Bible, but there's also a version of God that is more capricious. One author, Wellhausen, I think he probably, I don't remember exactly when he lived, but he might have lived around the same time and day as Hieronymus Bosch. Now that I think about it, it'd be really interesting if he did, because he posited the theory that the Elohim of the five books of Moses was different than the Jehovah of the five books of Moses. And he started splicing apart. His name was Wellhausen. He started splicing up where the name Jehovah was used and the name Elohim was used. And we start coming up with two completely different conceptions of God. Elohim is in the heavens, and he directs his angels to do things from there. And then Jehovah is on the earth. You read the first two chapters of Genesis, you'll see it. God said, and this was done. God said, and this was done. The next one, Lord God, he goes down and creates Adam and Eve himself. That's actually Jehovah. The first one, it's Elohim in the first chapter, and then the second one, it's Jehovah. And Jehovah has to go down to create man himself. He can't just do it with his word. Elohim does it with his word. So there's kind of an interesting string where there's two different conceptions of God. One is, you know, the vindictive Old Testament God that we all recognize. The other one is the more distant Elohim, who kind of represents the compassionate Father El that the Canaanites used to worship. So I hope I'm saying something that is good and worthy of discussion there.
Well,
but it's
just
interesting that Boss separates those two. He separates Elohim and Jehovah in his paintings.
Well, you're going right along with our philosophy that actually reflects a lot of the early Gnostic ideas that the Father, that the real Father God is not Jehovah, and the real Father God is corresponds with the ancient Phoenician and Canaanite El, and you know the El who was called the compassionate, and whereas Jehovah was jealous and wrathful, And so that goes right along with that, which of course was the view of a lot of the Gnostic sects. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm sure that we've stimulated the minds of our listeners, and I encourage them to take a look at Bosch but the main thing about this whole thing is stimulates creativity, and it establishes this link between the artistic creative process and the spiritual process, and that's what I think is really wonderful. And so thank you so much for coming on board in this, and thank you so much for perfecting and doing that operation and setting that whole thing up. And I really, really enjoyed it. I hope we've inspired some hermetic art lovers this evening. Next week we'll try to, I don't know, we're going to have a hard time topping this one, but next week we'll be back, and on the Hermetic Hour with another stimulating show. And until then, good magic.
All right, thanks for having me on. Good.